Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As a member of Generation X, the first time I laid hands on a computer was when I was in fourth grade. And the kind of technology that I carry around in my pocket today, the kind of technology that we all use and that today's children grow up with, was something we couldn't even fathom back then. Technology has changed dramatically, and in some ways, it's even changed us. This hour, we're exploring what it means to be a digital native today and some of the ways we can help our kids get the most out of this new technology. My first guest today is a lifelong tinkerer and a tech enthusiast. Dylan Schroltus is 24 years old, and he loves to take things apart and put things together. Dylan, hello.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And knowing a little bit about your background, it actually sounds like you're a little different than many people in your generation, but tell us when you first got interested in computers and technology.
Yeah, so my family got our first computer when I was either 9 or 10, and I almost immediately had this desire, this burning desire to just rip it apart, see how it worked. And my mom, being a very patient woman, didn't get too mad when I did that night, the first night we had that computer. So at that point, I just kind of was bit by the hardware bug and have had a lifelong love of just seeing how these kind of almost magical devices work on the inside.
Yeah, and let's go back about 15 years, because it was a little easier back then to learn about how computers worked on the inside. When you took that computer apart, I mean, you could look at the different pieces, right?
Exactly. And that's one of the things that, you know, I really had a lot of privilege in being able to access the technology and then access parts for replacement as well. I mean, that's something that kids today with their iPads and a lot of the technology that we have right now, availability of replacement parts, the ability to take things apart and maybe not be able to put it back together and then, you know, find some way of getting things to work again. It's just not quite as available today as it used to be.
Now, not all of us were taking computers apart and putting them back together 15 years ago. So what do you think you got out of that experience? What did you love about it?
Well, I think, you know, there's obviously the love of being able to use a computer, you know, being able to make it faster. But there's something a little bit deeper in that I was able to find a problem, you know, a computer that's running slowly, and I was able to find out why that was happening and figure out a way to resolve it. Or, you know, really, it's a problem-solving sort of orientation that I try to bring with it. And that with a sense of fun or a sense of play, because it is something that I'm doing, for entertainment or for you know, as a hobby. But yeah, so I think really it was that problem-solving, that desire to figure out, you know, why things did work the way they worked and why they were assembled the way they were assembled and how all of that fit together as a puzzle.
How did you learn to do all that?
A lot of trial and error. So that first time I took apart the computer, that first night we had it, it didn't get put back together correctly for, I think, about a month.
Parents were really patient.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, they had just spent a bunch of money on this computer, money that really, like, I didn't grow up wealthy. It was a big deal for us to get a computer. My mom needed it for work. And, she was an angel. She's an educator, so she has that background in dealing with difficult children like myself.
So, and your love of technology and tinkering, that it goes well beyond computers, right?
Yeah. I've done everything from building radios. I built a little microscope one time that was fun. And then actually now I work in the equipment repair field. I run IT for a small espresso repair company that operates from coast to coast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, and we're going to continue talking about your interactions and what you've gained from them throughout the hour. But I want to bring some of my other guests into the conversation. And next up is Juan Pablo Orcad, associate professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science. He's also the author of Child Computer Interaction. So Juan Pablo, you not only interact with technology yourself, but you study how young people interact with technology. And listening to Dylan, as I said, I mean, he sounds a little bit different than many people of his generation. What are some of the shifts that you see with how young people are interacting with technology as the technology has changed.
And good morning, Charity. I think there's been many changes from generation to generation. So if I think when I was a child in the 1980s, if you could learn some programming, you could make games, for example, that were not all that different from the games that that you play.
Right. We were playing Pong. You can code Pong pretty quickly, right?
It's not that difficult. Sometimes it was just one person making those games. Nowadays, games are blockbuster, have the budget of blockbuster movies or more, millions of dollars, and you just can't do it on your own anymore. So there's that side. I would say there's also the side of how we interact with computers. Again, in the 80s, it was text-based. For people of Dylan's generation, they might have grown up with graphical user interfaces. Now we're in a touchscreen generation with kids. Maybe the next one will be the voice assistant generation. It might change, but every generation, even if they're all digital natives, will have a different relationship with technology.
So not only have the barriers to entry been lowered by access, technology is, and there's still a digital divide based on socioeconomic circumstances, but technology has become much more within the grasp of most Americans than it was when we were growing up. Tech was really expensive back then, so not everybody was going to have a computer in their home. Now it seems like homes have all kinds of devices.
There's ubiquity of computing in our lives, in how we live our lives, how we find information, how we purchase items, how we make decisions. So computing is everywhere. And it's also more accessible to a wide variety of people, including very, very young children. And that's thanks to touchscreens. They're a good match for children's motor and cognitive abilities.
Right. So the keyboard and the mouse, what we use to interact with desktop computers, that was a barrier to entry for small children.
That's correct. For small children, it might have even been more of an issue for other populations, maybe perhaps some older adults. And now with touchscreens, things are simpler. And obviously that can bring some positive consequences and some negative ones too.
Well, and actually, we just got this email from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids, who says, "My wife is a computer science teacher at a large public high school and did not expect to have to teach her students how to use a mouse and navigate a conventional desktop PC environment. Many of them had to be shown how to click on various icons. I suppose they're now working solely with their touchscreens on phones and tablets, and working with clunky desktop interfaces is as foreign to them as it was to our parents." That's a fascinating observation. Is that something you've observed too?
Yeah, and actually we had been tracking skills with a mouse for some time, and the kids kept getting better at younger ages through the mid-2000s, and then after touchscreens came out, skills have gone out the window, and yes, many children don't have that experience.
Fascinating. Well, and how about keyboarding? I know that there's kids still have a class in junior high, at least in most districts, where they learn about computers. But we, of course, were learning how to type. Are young people learning how to type?
I think at that level, yes.
Okay.
They are learning. They do need to. They have assignments where they need to do a lot of typing. So, yeah. So that's still happening.
The kind of technology, so touch screens make technology accessible. But, you know, we were listening to Dylan talk earlier about taking that first computer apart. And if your first computer is a tablet, there are no moving parts. It's not something that you can take apart. It's not something that you can watch working. How do you think that changes our relationship with that technology?
Yes, I think there is a barrier to understanding what's inside and how it works, and it's a little bit of a black box in there. Whereas it used to be, as Dylan mentioned, the computers were designed so you could take them apart and improve them over time. You could still do that with desktop computers, but most of the devices that people are using are not designed for that. Actually, you will void your warranty with most of them if you try to open them up.
So that black box idea, do you feel like that makes our understanding of technology how does it change? I guess I'll just ask you, how does it change our understanding of the technology when the device that you're holding in the hand, in your hand, almost seems as if it's operating by magic?
Yeah, I think it may give people the wrong impression as to what's behind it. I think it's not just the hardware, but the software behind it. So, for example, a lot of people think computers really are smart, or that they might be upset at you if they're not working well. And understanding a little bit more, not just about the hardware side, but really the software side of things. So what's the code behind all the things that you see? What happens when you ask a voice assistant a question? Is it really a smart assistant, or is it just looking up a large database of information?
Interesting. We will talk more about that in a moment. Dylan, I would love to hear your thoughts as well on how that sort of almost magical quality of today's tech changes our relationship to it.
Yeah, well, so I actually have a really personal connection with this, because I'm trying to get my nephew, Logan, into coding and into technology, because he's got a wonderful mind for it. He's 11 now, I think. And he, you know, he has this fascination with technology. He's got an iPad that he plays on all the time, it seems like. But having that barrier, not being able to take it apart, not being able to understand it from a hardware perspective, in addition to, you know, the opacity of the software, he, you know, has a little bit of that, like, as you said, a barrier to entry into that space. So it really, you know, for me, it cements the idea that the more barriers we put up to entry into the technology space, into the understanding of it, more than just a black box, more than just magic, but understanding it as a physical device that human beings were able to create, you know, that impacts our ability to move forward and innovate, have the next generation of innovators and coders and hardware technology engineers.
Do you feel like that dampens his interest in it, in not being able to easily see how things are working? Does that make him less interested in finding out how things are working?
I think it really does. I mean, and I think the biggest thing for him and for my family, because, you know, there are other options out there other than iPads that you can have access to, like desktop computers or like a Raspberry Pi, a small microcomputer. But having that opacity, it really does impact, you know, his desire to learn more about it. It makes it so, okay, it just works. Let me leave it alone then, instead of wanting to dig into it.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We will talk more about how our relationship with technology is changing. With me, Dylan Schultes. He is 24 years old and loves to tinker. Juan Pablo Arcad is associate professor of the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science. And this is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
I was elected the majority leader.
This amendment broadens the scope of the bill.
What will this bill do to turn that around?
During the legislative session, Iowa Public Radio produces a weekly podcast.
We just want to make sure that it is something that is sustainable.
These are proven programs that work.
From committees to chambers, follow the path of bills and policies.
This bill lays out transparency in the process.
How can you say that with confidence?
The podcast Under the Golden Dome returns in January. Subscribe now for the 2019 legislative session.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how our relationship with technology is changing. As technology is changing, we're talking about what it means to grow up as a digital native in today's environment. We'll also talk about some of the ways we can help our kids get the most out of new technology. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your stories, your questions, your concerns. You can give us a call using old technology, or you can use your smartphone, too. You can call us at 866, I was going to give the fund drive number out. You can call us at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or you can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Juan Pablo Horcad, associate professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science, author of Child Computer Interaction. Dylan Schultes is here with us. He's 24 years old, and we've been talking about his love of tinkering, taking electronics apart and putting them back together. And Samantha Dalby is also with us now. She's the K-12 education coordinator at NuboCo, and she's the coordinator of Coder Dojo, which is a free program for students in kindergarten through fifth grade to learn tech skills. Everything from programming robots to developing websites is held on the first and third Saturdays of the month from 1 to 3 p.m. at Nubo City Market in Cedar Rapids. Samantha, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, happy to join you.
And we've been talking about how these tablets and smartphones and this technology that we can operate with the touch of a finger is changing our relationships. And I know that obviously coding is one of your passions, but I'd love to hear your thoughts to start with about things that you've observed maybe with your children or with other people's children about how that relationship is developing when so many children have a tablet in their hands almost as soon as they can walk and point at things.
Sure. So I think the curiosity is there the younger the student is. And like most things, we can, you know, wean it out of them, maybe unintentionally. And so one of the purposes of Coder Dojo is for the students to have open-ended exploration opportunities through different stations. And we do always try to offer some basic coding, some basic electronics or circuits, and then we like to have a rotation of different things, whether it's building structures, building robots, doing more advanced coding or more advanced circuits and things. And what I see, especially with the younger students, is that they're hungry to tear things apart. They do want to do it. They just haven't been said it's okay or maybe that it's even possible. And as we've talked earlier already in the program, they do tend to think that things are just a magic box. You know, I have a 4- and 7-year-old, and they don't understand why we can't get on the computer in the middle of the highway because wireless is everywhere, right? And even though there are hotspots and things like that, we don't want them to know that they can get on their iPad. So
right, you can pretend for yes, quite some time.
Some intentional naivety in there. But we kind of explored this this past summer with a camp that we ran called Tech Trash or Treasure. And we partnered with the Solid Waste Agency, their education director, Jason Evans. And he created a curriculum with us to actually tear apart technology that had been taken to the recycling center. So every day had a theme. The first day was movie day, and they took apart VCRs and DVD players. The next day was computers, where they ripped apart laptops and desktops. Then they did a tour, and then they got into mobile devices and found it's very hard to open mobile devices and to recycle them. And part of the idea was to show them that, you know, is it good to be throwing away our phones every year and getting something new because the next technology is, you know, coming out and so much faster and better? Can we reuse it? And what is actually inside of this technology? And then they created artwork on the last day with things that they found, using solar panels to make things move, using different magnetics in hard drives and things like that. So they were exploring. And we found that they were so excited about it. And the adults in our building that walked by wanted to join the camp as well. And once you give them the opportunity and say that you can do it, it's possible that you can take things apart, then they're very eager to. But I think when it doesn't have an obvious screw and you have to, you know, take glue apart and things like that, they may not even think that it's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And Juan, I know that you have studied how toddlers interact with this technology. I can imagine that when you've been touching a touchscreen for longer than you can remember, it's easy to take that kind of technology for granted. I mean, maybe you don't even think to be curious about it.
Yes, you do take it for granted. And I think there's some expectations of media being immediately available wherever you are. screens to be interactive. If they're not interactive, there must be something broken. So, yes, expectations have changed. But I do agree with Samantha about the curiosity, especially with very young children. They do want to know how things work. And especially if it's something new that they haven't seen before, there's a curiosity. And I think it's a great idea to find older hardware, because there's definitely plenty of that.
Right.
Around.
So what do we know about when kids are interacting with that technology, young kids, when they're interacting with the technology, what do we know about what is going on in their brains? Juan Pablo?
We probably don't know enough. I think in many ways the increase in use by very young children, so children under the age of 3, took a lot of people by surprise, myself included.
Yeah.
And it hasn't been studied that much, in part because early on the American Academy of Pediatrics was telling everyone no screen time for young children. So a lot of researchers didn't feel comfortable going to parents saying, let's see how your child is using this device.
Right. It was unethical to give a child more screen interaction than was recommended.
But now it's happening. And I think we're just starting to learn what might be the positive uses of technology and what might be some negative ones.
Interesting. Well, and Samantha, I'm curious. Obviously, there's a bit of self-selecting with the kids that come to Computer Dojo or Coding Dojo, and although that self-selecting might be done by their parents as well. But Juan Pablo was talking about sort of the magical ideas of these voice-activated, you know, maybe smart speakers or the voice-activated search on our phones that children, because they have names, they give them personalities, they have the idea that it is smart and it is thinking and it is a real sentient being. Do you encounter that with the kids that you work with, that kind of idea that, you know, the smart speaker is a person?
I would say that there's some of that around, and we try to encourage them and any students we work with to really see it as a device and that they are in control of it. And if it's not working the way that they expect or the way that they want, they can fix that. And talking about that problem solving and saying that computers are a tool that we can use, and how can you create with that tool instead of just consume the tool? That's another thing that we really want to push, because I would say the majority of our population consumes things. We use our phones a lot, but we don't create things with it. So really focusing on that and then breaking it down into a problem. So it didn't do what you expected. Okay, what did you tell it to do? Did it understand that? Oh, well, it's not smart enough to assume what you wanted it to do. You have to give it very specific instructions. And we see that when we're working with robots. You know, they say, okay, I want the robot to go get the ball. Well, how do you tell it to go get the ball? You have to break it down into that problem. So I think that is kind of decreasing that barrier of their perception of what the device is. And that's why we encourage play with that in a useful, in a creative way.
Interesting. Yeah. And I can see with both my son, who's 11, and my nephews, when they interact with a smart speaker and it doesn't understand them, they'd respond just by talking louder or by starting to yell. So I think we need to have some of these conversations for sure. When you start to tell kids about coding and what coding is, how do you introduce the idea to them?
Sure. So a lot of people think of coding as needing a computer. And there are tons and tons of activities you can do with students that are unplugged or away from the computer that still provide those same basic concepts. So it could be as simple as putting like a grid on the floor, on the wall, and having a student walk to different grids by giving instructions. Or they have to, you know, give another student instructions to draw a picture in a grid. And then you're actually learning some math concepts as well, sneaking it in there. One of my goals in life is to make people not afraid of the word algorithm. Seems like a big word. It seems kind of scary. But if you tell them it's just like a routine or a set of instructions, and that they do an algorithm probably every morning when they get up and they brush their teeth, they take a shower, they eat breakfast, and it's probably in the same order. Or for students, we're talking about how do we get up and go to lunch? What's our routine or our algorithm for that? It's just one of my goals in life. Don't be afraid of the word algorithm.
All right. Well, you've done good work here today. Maybe we're all making a little bit of progress along those lines. This hour, we're talking about how our relationship with technology is changing and how new technology may also be changing us. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and your experiences. How have you observed your children interacting or your grandchildren interacting with technology? What are your thoughts? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me, Samantha Dalby. She's K-12 education coordinator at Nubo Co. and coordinator of Coder Dojo, which is a free program for students in kindergarten through fifth grade to learn tech skills the first and third Saturdays of the month from 1 to 3 at Nubo City Market in Cedar Rapids. Juan Pablo Orcad is here, associate professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science and author of Child Computer Interaction. And Dylan Schroltuz is a tinkerer and a tech enthusiast. And Dylan, I'm curious, you were talking earlier about your nephew and trying to get him excited about coding. What is your observation and maybe your experience with him about introducing the idea of coding? Is that something that he was really receptive to?
Well, first off, I think I need to get him into this coder dojo program. That sounds awesome. I mean, the cutoff is 25, right?
Right. Anyone's welcome.
Awesome. Well, so my experience with getting Logan into it, when I started to frame it into the things that he was excited about. So he really loves Minecraft. So I started to frame it in, okay, let's make a mod for Minecraft. Let's change how the game works a little bit and see what happens. And once I started to frame it like that, I was able to inspire, I think, a little bit more of that curiosity, a little bit more of that spark of recognition of, oh, so Minecraft isn't just like something that appears. It's something that someone had to go in and code and program in line at a time and create from scratch. And kind of pitching it as a collaboration with that original software developer, he was able to, you know, create a little mod that changed the textures and made the game a little bit prettier. And he was really excited about that. And that, I think, was one of my most powerful experiences with him with that.
Well, and it's interesting, Juan Pablo, you were talking earlier about how so many games today, you know, have multi-million dollar budgets and are kind of impossible to think about coding. There has been this movement, and Minecraft is a great example of it, to get people involved with games where the coding is pretty obvious. I mean, do you see that as a big movement?
I would say it is a one way of getting more young people interested in coding. And the way that happens is you're not recoding Minecraft from scratch. You're just doing a modification of Minecraft or other games. And those tend to be a lot simpler and a lot easier to do. And they can be very rewarding because you're changing the game that you really enjoy. And you analyze the problem the way that Samantha was describing, decompose it. You think of a solution, you implement it, and then you see it happening there. And I think there's a lot of good feelings can happen when you put in hard work and you see the changes in something that you enjoy playing.
Well, I'm finding myself really being envious, Dylan, of your skill set and Samantha of your skill set, because, you know, in talking about facilitating this kind of coding and interaction, you're using skills that a lot of parents and a lot of grandparents don't have access to. So, Samantha, give us some advice for parents that don't know how to do this. How do you facilitate your child gaining these skills that you don't have?
Yeah, so we're actually in a very fortunate time right now where there's so many free or, you know, free that lead into subscription-based opportunities online for students as long as they have access to a computer or they can find the unplugged activities I mentioned earlier. But we find that the hardest part for adults is to not fix the student's problem. They are usually, you know, sitting beside them or behind them. They see them make a mistake and they want to jump in and they want to fix it. Don't do that. Let them struggle. Let them get frustrated. Talk them through, you know, and maybe guide them. But don't tell them how to do it or say, oh, I see what you did wrong, because that's the learning opportunity. And once you start doing that too frequently, that's when we see the students just sit back and go, it doesn't work. I don't know what to do. Someone will come and fix it. But if you let them struggle, then they get that reward of figuring it out and going, oh, I did this. I figured it out. And then, like Juan was saying earlier, there are multiple ways to solve problems in computer science. And so they may figure something else out that you didn't see. They've figured out maybe a longer way to do it. Maybe it's not the most efficient, but they still did it themselves. So my biggest recommendation is to find opportunities, go online. Hour of Code is a big thing this time of year, especially. They have great tutorials to walk students through at any age. But then let them do it. Let them explore and just be there as kind of a problem-solving guidance.
All right. So maybe the fact that I don't know how to fix the problems is an advantage,
yes,
not a disadvantage. So I'm curious, Juan Pablo, I mean, for kids who don't have that kind of facilitation, do you think that the interactions that kids are having with technology, even if they don't understand what's going on, do you think that growing up as this kind of a digital native, is that going to be a benefit to them in the future?
I think there's a couple of different ways that we can think about computational literacy. So some of the things that we have been talking about that Samantha is working on with kids, people refer to as computational thinking. So thinking about algorithms, decomposing problems, using abstraction. I would say there's another area that we could call computer literacy, which just might be more about understanding more generally how do computers work, how does the internet work, what is artificial intelligence, is it really intelligence or not, mm-hmm. How is our data getting collected, how is it getting analyzed. I think that those are some key skills that are a little bit different from computational thinking that are really important to pick up beyond just being a digital native and understanding how to use the technology.
Interesting. Do you feel like the curriculum that our kids are interacting with in schools, is that keeping up with the kind of computer literacy? I'm seeing a lot of heads shaking no.
No. If I can jump in, Charity. So this is another thing that we actually try to work on, because even though Coder Dojo is a great opportunity, it's just available regionally or wherever someone decides to do one, which, you, side note, you can do them very easily, so you can add them in your area. But one of the other things that NuboCo is doing is trying to help train in-service K-12 teachers on how to teach computer science so that students have access to this content and that they know what it is. They're more knowledgeable beyond just the data, the digital literacy and understanding how to use a computer, but what is computer science? And then they can choose to go into that career path, maybe some of them will, and fill some of our many jobs in Iowa. But even if having that general knowledge was going to help them, because most of our jobs are going to interact with someone who is doing software development or is related to technology, even if you're going into marketing.
And I want to pick up this thread in just a moment. I feel like there's a lot more to say about this. We're talking about our changing relationship with technology. Samantha Dalby is here, K-12 education coordinator at NuboCo in Cedar Rapids. Juan Pablo Orcad, associate professor at the University of Iowa, and Dylan Schroll-Tews. We'll be back in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how technology is changing, how our interactions with technology are changing. We're talking about what young people who are growing up as digital natives in this generation with this kind of technology, how that affects them, how that may influence the future. We're talking about how to raise good tech consumers and help young people understand the technology that they're using, maybe learn to code as well. With me this hour, Dylan Schroll-Tews. He is 24 years old and thoroughly enjoys taking things apart and putting them back together. Juan Pablo Orcad is associate professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science and author of Child Computer Interaction. And Samantha Dalby is K-12 education coordinator at NuboCo in Cedar Rapids and coordinator of Coder Dojo, which is a free program for students in kindergarten through fifth grade to learn tech skills at Nubo City Market, held on the first and third Saturdays of the month. And you are welcome to join the conversation as well. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, your thoughts, your observations, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And just before the break, I asked if you felt like our curriculums and schools are keeping up with the needs of students to help them understand the technology they're interacting with. I got a lot of head shaking no. And Samantha, I had to cut you off a little bit, but I can imagine if I were a teacher listening, I would also have that sinking feeling of, how do I keep up with all of this? I mean, that's an incredible challenge for schools, but it's one that you don't feel like schools are meeting right now.
Right. And we try to focus on the foundational concepts of computer science because those don't change while the technology does. And so that's one way to keep up with it is go to the things that don't change. So understanding some of the basics of, you know, breaking down problems, decomposition, global impact, how the internet works, talking about creativity and how you can create things with that, and then also getting into the programming and algorithms and things like that. And those, there's a wide variety of things. And I think that's what most people get nervous about is keeping up with that. But really just finding something that gets that initial need out there, because we don't have a lot right now. So something is better than nothing. And then you can build those skills. And what we're seeing in districts that are adding computer science is that the students really kind of drive the pace because their interest levels, they are the ones that are asking for specific classes, whether it's something on cybersecurity or game development, you know, going into more agricultural focus. And so if you provide those basic concepts initially in the K through 8-ish range and then start diving in deeper in the middle school and high school, they're really going to drive the interest levels of the students.
Yeah. Juan Pablo, what do you want to add about that? You also had a strong head shake of no, schools are not keeping up with this.
Well, I think in general, everyone's not keeping up with it. Or very few people are, and it's very difficult. There's been a lot of quick changes. I would say the big two that I see the last decade are the ubiquity of computing, which means a lot of what we do is getting recorded, and then big data, which means, yes, anything that is recorded will stick around for a long time, might be analyzed. Sometimes in ways that might benefit us, sometimes in ways that may not.
And when you say that, so many adults my age or older have a major fear response to that. They think, oh, well, then I don't even want to learn about this technology because I don't want that to happen to me. But so a lot of us, I think, choose ignorance as opposed to trying to figure out what that means for us specifically.
Yes. And I think if we perhaps made efforts in our schooling to address some of these issues and educate younger people, they might educate parents and grandparents as well. That's always a possibility. But I think it is having an impact on children. And I think that's one of the reasons we need to bring this up for them, because their lives are getting recorded like no other generation had been recorded before, oftentimes without their own them having any agency in how it's happening. So I think it will affect their lives, and in many ways it's already affecting their lives in ways that they don't have control over.
Let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Chris is on the line in Jefferson. Hi, Chris.
Oh, good morning. Hey, your guest mentioned Minecraft. There's a book that you can get that kind of gives tutorials on how to use Python to write your own code for Minecraft.
Okay.
I got that for my son, but, you know, it's like you can leave. My son's 8. So, you know, his computer, I put Ubuntu on it. I figure if he blows that up, I can just reload it. So then I try to set up little games for him, like why his network doesn't work. I do things like set up a speed mismatch or close the port or on the wrong VLAN or something. And then the other thing is about a year ago, he got his toy robot, and I thought it was just a stupid little toy. It was called Cosmo, and then I just did a little reading about this Cosmo robot, and I find out that there's a complete SDK available for it. And I'm like, wow, this is a kid's thing? Oh, no, this is, like, designed for college students and adults that want to learn robotic programming. So I kind of got him started on that. But, you know, he's 8 years old, so he's not real as focused on it as I'd like to see him be. But well, he'll get on it. He'll get older.
Well, Chris, thanks for bringing those up. There are so many resources out there now that are available and kits that you can buy and things like that. Samantha, I'd love to get your thoughts a little bit. And I'm not asking for, plugs for different kinds of technology. But as a parent, I am constantly marketed to all kinds of different devices. So give us some thoughts on what are good introductions. What are some of the things maybe we should be getting our hands on?
Sure. So last week, I actually heard a great quote from a software developer who gets frequently asked, how do I get started with computer science? And he said, do you have any problems to solve? So don't just say, I don't know, there's so much out there. Try to solve a specific problem. And with students in mind in particular, I say, don't try to force it on them, because, you know, I have kids that are 4 and 7 and they're going to push back and they don't want to do it.
And they push back more as they get older.
Yes. Oh, great.
Just wait.
But find something they're already interested in, because computer science is everywhere and can be used with everything. So maybe your student really likes to cook and they want to create a recipe app. Those exist, of course, but they create their own that has their own features. Maybe you have a student that's really interested in dinosaurs and they create a website about dinosaurs. I have an example with my 7-year-old. She collects these num-noms, which I hate. I'll just, sorry, num-noms, not plugging them. But they're a collector item for kids, right? And she wanted to keep track of the ones that she has and the ones that she wants. And they, of course, have a printout on their website. But when they add new ones, she has to print out a new one and transfer it. So she said, well, Mom, why can't I just create an app to track them? And so it's like, okay, now I'm into it, because she's actually learning skills related to this interest she has. So try to find whatever they're interested in. If they like games, there are things that are out there that are they're game-based, teaching them the code, and they control characters that move through mazes and have to do different quests and things like that, but they're using code to guide them. And that's just my recommendation. So don't try and shove it in. Just try and add it on top of something they're already into.
When you say creating an app, what kind of materials do you have to be able to do something like that?
Sure. So some ones that are targeted at students or really anyone that's getting started, App Inventor from MIT, and then Code.org has one that's called App Lab. And those are both have the options of drag and drop, or you can do like JavaScript to program those, and you end up with an end result application.
All right. And Juan Pablo?
Yeah, and one point I wanted to make is just about all the tools are free also. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to spend money to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Although there are lots and lots of things that you can spend money on out
yes.
there. And my 11-year-old also, we have pretty strict controls about screen time. And when he's coding, we don't have the same controls. And so his sister was complaining about him using the computer longer than he was supposed to, and he kept yelling, "I'm coding." So I'm not sure if that's a positive or a negative thing. And Dylan, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well. I mean, you talked about how transformative it was for you to get your hands on a computer when you were 10 years old. What do you think about devices these days and the kinds of things that kids should be having their hands on?
Oh, I think the diversity of options to get really introduced into the tech space is really cool right now. I mean, having access to a lot of those free online tools, and then a lot of, a lot of paid tools, of course, and paid hardware tools as well. You know, my entry was always in the hardware side of things. So things like the Raspberry Pi have always been really cool to me, where you can kind of take it and you can
extend
it. And
what is, explain that to us.
Oh, yeah, the Raspberry Pi. So it's a single board computer that you can get for... You can get a starter kit for like $60 or so online. And it's just basically a small, runs its own operating system called Raspbian. And on it, there's a bunch of preloaded tools, games that you can play, a free version of Minecraft, and then a bunch of coding tools as well, so that you can learn not only the hardware extension, where you can add on things like LED lights or little motors, little fans, different things like that, temperature sensors, humidity sensors, all sorts of different things you can add on to it, and you can program in ways for it to interact with those. And you can write
so
in
similar,
tools.
Kano Computing is another very similar product that we see around a lot as well.
Yeah, very similar. And so I think, having all of these options out there for kids, I mean, STEM toys are some of the most fastly selling ones on Amazon right now. I know, because I was just looking for Christmas presents. and it's, I don't know, I'm really amazed by it. I think there's a lot of really cool stuff happening in the tech space right now for kids. I'm actually getting my nephew one of those little mini computers for learning this stuff as well right now. And it's, it's more accessible now than it ever has been in the past. You know, being able to, for really a relatively small amount of money, being able to buy a fully functional computer with a, you can even get one with a little touchscreen for, I think, $100 total. And being able to show them not only how it works from the software perspective, being able to go in and show them, the basics of how the operating system works and how to extend it with scripts like Java, Python, et cetera. Like the caller was saying, Python isn't a really great tool to learn for Minecraft extension. You're able to really engage with it in a way that maybe I didn't necessarily have. I got into the coding side of things to cheat at video games, not necessarily to program them. So
you learned a lot that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was very motivated to do better at these video games by my peers.
And Samantha, you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, just kind of piggybacking on the hardware aspect of it. While I think it is getting harder to tear things apart, we have more opportunities to build things through sites like Adafruit, and because of YouTube and being able to share projects, especially in like the maker community, Students or people of any age can see a tutorial. They can create their own hardware device with lights blinking and buzzing and whatever. You can trick out your shoes and make it light up when you walk or whatever you want to do. But then you can modify it, especially if you learn the coding. You have the hardware in place and you've built that, and then you can control it. So I think those opportunities are more than back in like the Radio Shack days when maybe people didn't know how to do that or they didn't have a Radio Shack in their community. So just having access to those, and they're fairly inexpensive. I think I bought a kit to make LED rings do different whatever I want, you know, for like $30.
Oh, wow. Let's go to the phones. Ashley is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Ashley.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
So I just wanted to talk about smart homes. My boyfriend, Dan, who Dylan knows, actually, he has been tinkering with our smart homes and messing around with lights and the whole Google aspect. And when you guys were talking about the robots earlier, about how you have to tell it to do exactly very specific things, I thought that was really interesting, and it correlated with that. So I was wondering if anybody on air has a smart home and how they saw like the tinkering aspect to the smart home and if there was a correlation.
All right, who wants to respond to that?
Yeah, I don't have a smart home. I think it's a challenge because we're getting more and more smart devices, and the whole idea of Internet of Things and smart homes is coming together. I think the way it's likely to turn out to some degree is that there's companies like Amazon that are telling manufacturers to put little chips on whatever they make so it can be controlled through their voice assistants, for example. But there's still some element of programming that you could do, and I think that might be an opportunity for perhaps more people to get into it and, I don't know, clap your hands when you come in and something happens.
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for the tinkering. I know when I was an intern in college, I worked at a company as a software engineer, and they made hardware, and they had a device where simply described, like, if the magnets separated, then it would send a signal. And there was a snack room that the interns put this device on so that we knew when the snack room door opened, because that's usually when they were restocking it. And of course, it wasn't like the perfect solution because someone could go in to get a snack. But we knew after about, you know, 10 or 20 or something snack door opens, then they restocked it. So we didn't have to go check the room. So things like that, it's not like going to save the world, but it was a fun way to tinker. And I think people can do that in their own homes where they can check if their garage door is open or not and then close it. Those are effective. But then we also get into everything's connected to Wi-Fi. And do you have your Wi-Fi open so that other people can access it? That kind of data literacy of security and privacy and things like that. We start opening the door and it could be a can of worms.
All right. I see a lot of concern in that in this room about that as well. So we only have about a minute left. I guess so far my takeaway is that I need to learn quite a lot. So Samantha, just give us some parting wisdom for parents, for grandparents, for older people who want their kids, want to open the door for their kids, but may not have the skill set themselves.
Sure. So don't be afraid. Fear or use that fear to kind of drive encouragement and learn alongside your student. The kids are going to be really excited about it, really engaged most likely. And you can be too. You don't have to be afraid. Doesn't matter what age you are. And that's the great thing about technology. It is moving so quickly that even people that have a background in it, they don't know everything. No one is like an expert in all areas of technology. They just have the ability and the confidence to know that they can figure it out. So you can figure it out. You can too.
Is there a danger for parents who get really excited about this introducing things that are not age appropriate, or, you know, trying to push things a little too fast?
It can be, especially if you are the one that's driving the interest. And that's where I would definitely figure out what your students' interests are and maybe start with some of the ones that are more game-based and exciting, especially if they like playing video games. And then it's an easy transition to get them into creating things on their own.
Samantha Dalby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Samantha Dalby, K-12 Education Coordinator at NuboCo in Cedar Rapids. Juan Pablo Ocad, thank you.
Thanks.
Juan Pablo Orcad, Associate Professor at the University of Iowa's Department of Computer Science and author of Child Computer Interaction. And Dylan Schultz, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.